Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's teleconference, ARS Small Cap Strategy Update. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historically facts are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties, and actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS most recent outlook and the ARS website for important legal and disclosure information. There will also be a Q&A at the end of the call. Note that all lines will be muted onto the Q&A portion of the call. We will provide you instructions on how to ask a question at that time. With that, I will turn the call over to Steve Burke. Steve, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, and welcome to today's call. Let me start by saying we appreciate you taking time out of your busy days to join us. We're going to try and keep the call moving. For the next 20 minutes or so, Russ and I will discuss the strategy, and then we'll take some live questions. For those who are on previous small cap calls, we will actually be identifying the securities that we're discussing in the questions. So in the past, we used generic descriptions of the companies. We'll be giving you the names of the companies as we go through. So with that, let's just get started. Back in November, we had a call on the strategy, and since then, and during last year, the strategy had not performed to our expectations, but we remain very positive on the strategy for a number of reasons. The first is that historically, small and micro-cap stocks have outperformed large-cap stocks by 2 to 3% a year, but have demonstrated periods of underperformance like we've been experiencing recently. However, if you look back to the early 70s, about 60% of the rolling five-year periods, small caps have outperformed the large-cap end of the market. That hasn't been the case in the recent years, but it's also the reason why we're positive on the outlook. The second reason why we're positive on the strategy is that the businesses inside the portfolio are all doing quite well. The stock prices do not capture the strength of the underlying businesses. And in a market where value is hard to find, we believe that this is one of the areas representing some of the most significant undervaluation available for investors. And part of that's because there are some significant natural buyers sitting on the sidelines. Both core public companies and private equity money has about over $4 trillion of cash waiting to make strategic and financial acquisitions. And when they do, the small cap area is the typical area of targets for it, and we expect that to continue. So pursuing undervalued investments is a tough approach if you're an impatient investor, but for those with the right discipline, patience, and judgment, it pays off, and we're very confident that the strategy will pay off for investors. We're fortunate to have Russ managing the strategy, as he's done for over 30 years, successfully running money in a similar fashion. So those are the reasons why we remain optimistic about it. You're going to hear about the undervaluation as we go through the call. But let me start by reviewing the strategy for a minute. The ARS-focused small-cap approach takes a public equity approach to the private equity approach to the public markets. We're looking for companies that we view are selling for at least a 50% discount to their intrinsic value. We invest in 15 to 20 stocks using this high-conviction approach, and we work as an involved investor, which means we work in concert with other stakeholders, either the management board or other shareholders, to help close the valuation gap that we've identified. So with that, I'm going to ask Russ a series of six questions, and then we'll open it up for clients. But let me get started. Russ, on the Q4 conference call, I cited some dislocation in the market that we felt would dissipate and that the January effect for small cap stocks would turn in our favor. But January came and went without a strong move in small caps. Why do you think that is?
Well, Stephen, I think first and foremost, the investors stayed on the sidelines after the tax loss selling season ended, and that is usually not the case. And we believe that these investors, or the balance of investors staying on the sidelines, has led to lower than expected buy interest, and that's driven volume down and has allowed, in many cases, the sellers who want to, you know, liquidate part of a holding in these types of names to call the tune in the opening weeks of the year. Historically, that's not the case, particularly not the case in the first part of the year. And we think investors have stayed on the sidelines for a variety of reasons. This is an area that this segment tends to benefit from a risk-tolerant investor, meaning that someone who's a more comfortable investor with the outlook for the economy and the market. And so far this year, we've nearly started a shooting war with Iran. We've had an impeachment trial of the president, only, what, the third time in history. And then we had to hold our breath while waiting to see if the trade deal that had been agreed to in principle would actually end up being signed. And then late in January and February, we also ended up getting the coronavirus, which has impacted expectations for global growth, particularly in Asia and China. As I said before, investors tend to view these names as things that benefit from confidence and or catalysts, and we believe that right now they're also, the segment's also being hurt a bit by a lot of the money that's been chasing a select number of names, something such as Tesla, which was up 100% at one time in the first few weeks of the year, which just sucks up kind of risk capital and pulls people's attention away from these types of names that represent real values to things that represent market opportunities. That being said, we continue to be exceedingly confident and upbeat about the opportunities these names represent and the fact that before the year is out, we think that investors will begin to work their way back into these names and start to close the valuation gaps.
Well, many of the reasons that were forces that caused security prices to depart from the underlying value, we often find are temporary. Core to our investment approach is the view that securities trade in an auction market, and we believe that that auction market is represented by significant inefficiencies. Why do you think the market is undervaluing these businesses so much today?
Well, it's interesting. You hear a great deal about how there's no value left in financial assets and that the stock market is fully, if not overvalued. The same goes for the bond market, which has had a decade-long, plus-long, historically strong performance and to a point where in bonds, I'm not even sure whether they offer value or safety. High yield is in many cases somewhat the same, where a chase for yield has caused many investors to abandon traditional protections they would want built in to buying those kinds of investments. And even in private capital, you have a situation where the massive pool of unspent capital has compelled some players to get involved in deals that simply carry multiples that they would never have considered paying for an asset in the past. So with markets going up, people looking for some place to put capital, a lot of money chases what's working. And in this segment, while it hasn't been working, it is the one segment I think we can confidently say we believe is grossly undervalued. The significant undervaluation exists because, by and large, investors have been pulling money out of the equity market for a number of years. And the money that's been staying in the market has moved into a concentrated group of holdings. I believe right now the top five companies in the S&P 500 account for nearly 20% of the index. This has resulted in steeper valuations because when you buy an index fund, you're not doing price discovery work. And that's meant that a number of companies are the real beneficiaries of this growing concentration and increasingly high valuation. A lot of the best opportunities, however, have been starved of new money flow. History, as you mentioned, Steve, tells us that this has happened before and it does self-correct. Whether it's 2001, 2002, or 2012, 2013, time does bring money back to this segment, and when it does, the performance in this segment tends to be exceedingly strong. We are confident that time will work in our favor and that the market will move. We're just not quite sure exactly when it's going to come, although I do think we're very confident about why it's going to come. We, as I mentioned before, we expect to see meaningfully money flow into this space as we see investors and private capital players and the like start to get involved in the space, undergoing transactions and things of that nature, And when people start to see the valuation premiums that are being done for stocks in this segment, we think greed will overcome.
In January, it was remarkable how the market shrugged off the issues with Iran, the impeachment, and then that was buoyed by the signing of the trade deal, which was anticipated, but it was also anticipated last spring. But now we have the new issue facing the markets, which is the outbreak of the coronavirus, which creates another level of uncertainty. How has the virus played into your approach to your portfolio holdings? Have many been impacted, and can you give some examples of those that haven't have not been?
Well, first, we expect that coronavirus will have very limited long-term impact on the investment markets. In our portfolio, in this portfolio, we think that it's going to have little direct impact. We reviewed the portfolio for direct exposure, and by that, we mean companies that either generate a significant portion of their revenues and earnings in China, use China as a manufacturer of products, or rely on China as a significant part of their supply chain. And we came up with only four names where we thought there was significant exposure. Atlas Air, which is an air freight company, Callaway, which manufactures golf clubs and clothing, Lovesac, which is a furniture company, and Rogers, which is an electronics components company. Lovesac and Callaway both rely on China to produce products that they sell here in the U.S., although Lovesac last year, in response to the tariffs being put on China, began to move its supply chain out of the country and has indicated that by the middle of this year, they will no longer rely on China for any part of their supply chain. Callaway does rely on China much more. It uses China particularly as a source of casting for golf equipment and things of that nature. And in the first quarter, they came out and announced that they expect, or in the fourth quarter, that they expect first quarter earnings to be down somewhat significantly because of the inability to get product out of China. For Atlas, which is, as I said, is an air freight systems operator, its cargoes tend to be high value added items, electronics, things of that nature, and they flow in and out of China, and so the slowdown in manufacturing of electronics and the slowdown in use of electronic components and end products is going to, we think, act as a drag on their earnings. That being said, Atlas Air is currently trading at less than 6x earnings. And so we really think that the market has already pretty strongly anticipated some of these issues. The last name we see where there's a direct impact is Rogers. Rogers manufactures components used in everything from 5G to electric vehicles. And China has been the early leader in 5G, and we have seen some slowdown in China 5G rollout in part because of the coronavirus. And we also expect to see lower volumes of electric vehicles produced and the like. So we would think that Rogers is going to see a drag in the upcoming quarter from the impact of coronavirus. We do have a number of names or a couple of names that have an indirect linkage. My favorite indirect linkage, or least favorite, if you can't catch the sarcasm, is a company, Mitchum Industries. Mitchum used to be an oil service provider, but it now provides underwater acoustic sensing technologies that are used for scientific and security end markets. Unfortunately, it's still listed in many algorithms and ETFs as an oil service play, and so when oil prices collapsed in the first part of this year in response to significantly lower China demand, the stock symbol, Mitchum, got dragged along with it. And the second name that's been dragged into the mix and hasn't seen any real fundamental shift is Red Lion. Red Lion operates mid and upscale hotels, particularly in the western part of the United States. But the whole segment has seen money flow out of it as people get concerned about reduced air travel, reduced vacation stays, reduced cruises, and things of that nature. So Red Lion has so far been struggling to get its feet back underneath it.
Thank you. There's a lot of uncertainty around China to begin with the slowing of their economy, with the changing supply chains, as you mentioned, and now adding to it the coronavirus. There's it's the second largest economy. It does put a crimp on global growth. offsetting that is some of the work that the central banks and China themselves are doing to stimulate the global economy and the domestic economy as well. So it's a very fluid situation, and we're going to manage accordingly. Russ, the next question I'd like to ask is, can you share a recent sale and purchase that you made in the portfolios and give some background on each?
Okay. The sale will be Kratos, and Kratos is a manufacturer of unmanned aerial vehicles, and it supplies components and services to defense contractors both in the U.S. and in the Western world. It has a wide variety of applications for its equipment, including air defense and surface-to-surface weaponry. While we still see upside in the name, we became very concerned when we saw a significant wave, in fact, the first significant wave of insider selling that we've ever seen in the company. Every senior officer sold off a substantial portion of their holdings. Additionally, a private capital firm, which had long been Kratos' largest shareholder and its biggest backer, participating in every secondary the company did, even when a lot of pundits on the street said the company was going to go broke, sold off or distributed to its investors its entire holding. That firm had a member of the company on the board of Kratos, and that board member resigned and sold off his not inconsequential holdings as well. So when we saw the breadth and the magnitude of this insider selling, it caused us significant enough concern that we felt that given the stock's valuation, which is had grown to 48 times out-year earnings and 27 times out-year enterprise value to EBITDA, we felt that it was appropriate that we step away and do more digging to understand why this wave of selling occurred. The buy would be a company called Smith Micro. Smith develops and markets apps that are used to address three primary user needs. One is family location and parental control through a product called SafePath. The second is a voicemail management service, which includes translating voicemail into text or emails, and they call that ComSuite. And the third is an enhanced customer experience in stores and online called ViewSpot. Smith's largest customer had been for SafePath, which is its lead product, had been Sprint, and there was investor concern that when the T-Mobile Sprint deal concluded that T-Mobile might well end up actually dumping Sprint. T-Mobile has a significantly inferior product, and we made the investment after we saw that the player supplying T-Mobile's product actually signed an agreement with Smith to integrate their offering with Smith's SafePath capabilities. So in essence, that will then now give Smith access into the T-Mobile network where before it had none. We think that, you know, this company that made the arrangement with Smith, a company called Coolpad, is someone Smith has worked with in the past. They have a history of working very successfully together, and we're excited about the opportunities that this will present. And while Smith does sell at 20 times 2020 expected earnings, it sells at less than 5 times revenues and 14 times EBITDA, and we foresee the company growing the top line at a 25% or better growth for the next several years.
Thanks, Russ. We believe many of the companies in the portfolio are mispriced. Can you give an example of one that was mispriced in the market last year and the difference between the price action and your valuation based on business fundamentals?
Well, we would agree. I do agree that the portfolio was filled with significantly mispriced holdings, and I could spend a lot of time talking about each and every one of them. The one I'm going to mention here is ChemBio, however. ChemBio, which we've talked about in the past, produces a wide and growing portfolio of rapid blood tests, meaning 10, 15 minute or less tests used to detect everything from febrile diseases like malaria, chikungunya, dengue, and Zika to sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and HIV. The company is backed with research dollars from everyone from a wide range, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Paul Allen Foundation, BARDA, which is a branch of the U.S. government where, a little bit like DARPA for defense, they give money to people to push the envelope of science, and BARDA's been a big supporter of ChemBio, as well as a number of well-known major pharmaceutical players, including people like AstraZeneca and Takeda. The company has indicated that it expects to nearly triple its revenue base between 2019 and 2023. It's taken steps in the last year that are going to cut its cost of goods sold from 85% of revenues down to about 50% of revenues by the middle of this year through automation and the bringing online of a facility in Malaysia. They got World Health Organization approval for an important new product in a sexually transmitted disease segment. They got a UN purchase order for an important new febrile disease test, and they've had no regulatory setbacks. They've secured additional working relationships with a number of big cap pharma companies for tests that will be linked to treatment regimes that these other big cap pharma companies are developing for a number of very interesting or, you know, very big, powerful potential diseases, including cancer and respiratory diseases. They're working on products that include a concussion test where they've identified biomarkers that occur when one has a concussion, and they believe that this market alone, the concussion market alone, could be a $2 billion market in the U.S. There is no concussion test available. There's no way other than asking people a series of questions and hope they give you honest answers as to whether or not they've had a concussion. So in spite of all these successes, ChemBio was trading at less than 2x sales, and we believe that if it were a private company, and in fact I've talked about this company to private investors, they tend to view this company as being worth 2.5x its current price, or north of $10 a share. A second name I'll mention here is GP Strategies. GP Strategies provides training for corporations and governments. They're perhaps the only player in their industry that has a global presence. Worker training was a major theme in our last outlook, and GP addresses many of the problems we were referencing there. This is a company that has a history of returning capital and enhancing shareholder value. They are very important in building out a skilled workforce, and as we talk to CEOs, we find the number one thing they encounter is a shortage of qualified workers. Over the next 2 years, GPX should grow revenues by an annual rate of over 15%, and earnings per share should more than double. And yet, in spite of all of this, in a market that's trading at 18x earnings or better, GPX trades at 12x earnings and 7.5x EV to EBITDA, which leaves us feeling that you could easily see this stock appreciate 50% or more and not have it be overvalued.
Great. Last question before we open it up to client questions. We often like to ask ourselves, what's the question that clients aren't asking us that we want to discuss? So let me ask this one. If the current portfolio is priced as a private equity portfolio as opposed to what we've experienced priced in the public markets, how do you think the portfolio would have done last year, and why do you think that's important for clients to understand?
Well, I'll cut to the punchline first, and I think the answer is that if this were a private capital portfolio and we were to value it using the metrics that private capital firms tend to use to value their holdings, we believe the portfolio would have kept up or even exceeded the performance of the equity markets last year. This is because private capital firms tend to value companies based on either their underlying fundamental performance against internal benchmarks or on their last round of financing. When you look at our portfolio, with only a handful of exceptions, where I'd highlight their Red Lion and perhaps Atlas Air, the companies are performing operationally and strategically at or even above the levels we expected them to be performing at going into 2019. Unfortunately, as we've often said, the problem in the small cap world is that price is often determined not by the most knowledgeable investor, but by the least knowledgeable investor. In the short run, a seller driven by a desire for liquidity can undo the work of a understanding, knowledgeable, long-term investor. And this means that you oftentimes see stocks perform poorly in the short run simply because someone doesn't understand what's going on and they look to get out. When we look at our portfolio and measure it by 12-month upside projected price targets from sell-side analysts who follow these companies, we get an upside of nearly 90%. That's 90%, or an almost doubling of the current price. As I mentioned before, our companies continue to perform operationally at or above our expectations, so the underperformance so far has been in the markets, not really in the businesses. And this means that in the long run, as the saying goes, value will out. And we believe share prices will move to reflect improving fundamentals, and if they don't move to reflect improving fundamentals, strategic buyers or financial buyers will recognize what the market does not, and they will step in to create strategic events which will close the valuation gaps. We, as Stephen mentioned earlier, work on a number of fronts to help close the valuation gaps we see, be it by working with a management to tell their story better, working with a board to make strategic adjustments in their business portfolio, or changes in corporate leadership, or at times with other shareholders to help change the character of a board. By working with these shareholders, we have found it does help accelerate the realization of value. And lastly, in preparation for this call, I reviewed the portfolio and adjusted year-end closing prices to what I would have valued them at, or roughly what I would have valued them at if I were a private capital investor, and I came out with a huge valuation discrepancies in many cases. And I'll mention just a couple. One is Reading, which is a movie theater and real estate development company, where a TPG-backed investor bid $18.50 a share for the company early last year. And if you understand the way private capital guys work, that tends to mean that that private buyer saw a value in Reading shares of $30-plus dollars a share. The stock closed the year just over 11. Eastside Distilling, which is a distiller specializing in developing brands and then selling them off, is another excellent example. Late last year, meaning in the fourth quarter, they bought a tequila brand. They were not the highest bidder for the brand, and the buyer took stock from them as opposed to taking cash. The buyer also kicked in a not inconsiderable sum of money to help support marketing integration efforts between the tequila brand and the rest of the company. And so when you netted out what they got in value for their stock that they gave to the tequila brand, it was over $6.25 a share. The stock closed the year trading under 3. In our sum of the parts valuation is between $10 and $12 a share, which is 3 to 4 times what the stock ended the year trading at. Another name is Monarch Cement, and cement's a pretty esoteric business. There's not a lot of mystery in what's going on if you're valuing a cement company, and yet Monarch trades at a third of what we think it's worth as a strategic investment and probably half of what it would be worth if we were to be valuing it as a private capital player. And last, I'm going to toss in an example of how or why this happened. Late last week, one of our holdings, Tech Precision, reported numbers. They missed expected earnings per share because they took on a project at the behest of a major new player in their space, and they supply components to submarines and aircraft carriers, two long-life programs. The submarine program should have a 20-year life. The incumbent supplier to this one prime could not execute on a very important component. The prime went to Tech Precision and asked them if they would take it on. They took it on, and while they could not get it worked out inside the terms of the prior contract, which cost them money and meant they actually had a small loss for the quarter, they did solve the problem. And what was interesting is a lot of the problem appears not to necessarily have come with the engineering, but rather the specs that were given the company. I remember years ago, Boeing had this problem where they had an Italian company ship them components for the 777 that were measured metric, and Boeing had actually sent them the measurements over in inches, which created a small technical glitch. But what Tech Precision has done is it has solved a major problem for a big player in the space. It has saved them some embarrassment by executing the strategy. They have built a strong relationship with this player, and it's going to lead to multiples of the loss being returned in the way of top-line business and bottom-line profits. So while the equity market has sold the stock off reasonably aggressively in the last couple of days, we and others who we talk to who understand and know the investment actually saw the last quarter as the best quarter the company has had in the last 4 to 5 years. So that kind of gives, you know, that's the thing we're facing is you've got a market that's focused on a measure that's tangible to it, but isn't necessarily tangible to the people who will buy. To give you an example, we recently had a conversation with the CEO of a company in the space that Tech operates in, and they told us that they valued a company like Tech at 15 times or more enterprise value to EBITDA, which would lead to an upside in Tech Precision of somewhere between 67 and over 100%.
Thanks, Russ. Let's open it up to questions now. Michelle?
All right. Yes. As we move to Q&A, please press pound 2 on your telephone keypad to enter the question queue. You will hear a notification once your line is unmuted. At that time, please state your name and question. Once again, pound 2 will indicate that you wish to ask a question. Thank you. Still waiting for questions, but at this time, there are no questions in queue.
Okay, well, we would welcome any questions you have, so feel free to give us a call. Getting us to stop talking about our stocks is harder than it is to get us to talk about them. We appreciate the time that you've taken out of your day. We'd love to answer any further questions or provide any further clarifications. It's clear we're excited about the strategy. It's very in line with the outlook, and our outlook remains intact. We think the economy is going to continue to do well for the U.S., but there will be more volatility and uncertainty, particularly as the coronavirus plays out. But that will give opportunities for knowledgeable investors who are taking advantage of the opportunities. So, Michelle, if we don't have any questions, we'll close off the call.
Yes, at this time there are no questions. Last minute, if you'd like to ask a question, please press pound 2. Okay, there are no questions in queue. That concludes our conference. Thank you for using Event Services. You may now disconnect.